for the week of August 30th, 2009, this is Showbiz Sandbox Episode 18, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In a very smoky Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And also in a very smoky Los Angeles, this is Karen Woodward.
And outside Chicago, this is Michael Gills.
You know, it's not really that smoky where I am, though.
Is there a forest fire or what's going on in Los Angeles?
What's going on? Are you kidding me?
It's near Pasadena, right?
Yes, it's the Station Fire. It presently is burning 85,000 acres of land, or maybe 185,000 acres of land. Two firefighters died fighting the fire on Sunday. It has doubled every single day. The fire department has said it's out of control. They have no containment on it whatsoever. And from where I'm sitting now, which is at one end of the San Fernando Valley, the western end, I can see a smoke cloud that rises 20,000 feet into the air. And then in the evening, I can see the fires. I mean, they're 25, 30 miles away, but I can see the fires kind of rolling down the hills like lava. It's pretty dramatic.
Wow.
That's unnerving.
Yes.
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, when we're not fighting forest fires, we're going to be talking about Disney purchasing the Marvel Comics world and all their characters, which is huge news and will have repercussions in theme parks and movies and television and everything else you can think of. We're going to discuss briefly Avatar trailer, a little bit more news on that. We're going to talk about Julia Roberts' new movie, Duplicity, which has just come out on DVD and is, I think, one of the best movies of the year. We've got a story about Megan Fox, who was in the summer hit Transformers, and her playing on Xbox Live, which every geek in the world should be crazy about. We got a quick item on how movie directors are all old white men, which is really not news. We've got a remake watch talking about Rob Zombie and The Blob. We've got a lot of music news. We've got Noel Gallagher quitting Oasis again. We've got the two finalists for American Idol, Chris Allen and Adam Lambert, joined at the hip. They're both going to release their debut albums on the same day. The Michael Jackson's death is getting more and more serious. It's been ruled a homicide, and the doctor who was in charge of him when he died is probably in serious trouble. And the Jackson family has agreed to do a reality show, which is really the graceful, classy thing you want to see after the most famous member of your family dies.
Absolutely.
Paula Abdul is winning some and losing some, having a lot of issues, but looks like she's going to be on VH1 Divas. And Jay Leno show has announced its first week guests. And of course, as always, we start with the box office. Isn't that right, Sperling?
That is. But since you've covered everything, thank you very much for listening. And
No, I was just going to say,
you can subscribe on iTunes.
Was that too detailed?
How much has happened? I was gone for 4 days. I was like, no TV or anything. I was in Kennebunkport, Maine, and like all this stuff happened. And I come back and I was like, oh my God, I didn't even know about the forest fires. I mean, this is all very handy. No, we are not closing up shop now. We're going to talk.
And there's a lot to talk about the box office. I'm excited.
You're excited right. about the box office?
I am.
Okay, well, the movie that got so wonderfully reviewed over the weekend, it opened on Friday, The Final Destination. Not Final Destination, The Final Destination. In 3D, in North America, made $28.3 million on 3,100 screens and came in first place in North America over the weekend.
And $9 of that money was mine.
Ugh, why?
Was it good?
I feel it's my duty as a Showbiz Sandbox correspondent slash co-host to see the big movie of the week, whatever it may be. So if it's going to be, you know, the big new opening, I'm going to go. And it was not good. But I do like the premise of Final Destination. It's really fun. You know, you evade death somehow, and then death gets to hunt you down and kill you in really imaginative ways. And I've never seen the other movies. But what was sort of fun about this film is you're rooting for people to die, and they don't want you to feel bad about that. So they make everyone as hateful as possible. Even your heroes tend to do something obnoxious or stupid or annoying right before they die, just so you can be glad that they die. And they have a little bit of fun with it, but they should have had a lot more fun. But it did sort of keep my interest a little bit. But no, not a great movie.
Well, plus you'd already seen Taking Woodstock.
Yes, I had seen Taken, which I knew would be a bomb. I don't know how strongly I said that before, but I didn't expect to do anything, and it really opened to nothing.
Well, it came in ninth place, and it made $3.74 million on 1,393 screens in North America.
So, what I loved,
I had an opportunity to see that for free, and I passed. Isn't that sad?
It's a boring movie. What I like is that I think box office profits said, at 3. Whatever million, that's not bad for that many screens. I'm like, 1,300 screens, you can make $50 million on 1,300 screens. You know, that's a lot of screens, and that's a disaster any way you paint it.
Well, Inglourious Basterds is not a disaster. It came in second place in its second week in theaters. It made $20 million on 3,165 screens. That's a drop-off of 47% over its opening weekend. But to date, it has made $73.76 million in North America for a film that cost $73 million to make. So Quentin Tarantino must be very happy, as are most likely the Weinsteins.
Yeah, and I still haven't seen it.
Oh, Karen, Karen.
I've been out of town. I haven't had time.
You're a busy woman. That's true.
I'm extremely busy woman.
It's about to be his highest grossing film of all time. It'll probably become Quentin Tarantino's highest grossing film. I'm almost certain it'll pass, you know, the $101 million of Pulp Fiction. So I feel very pleased, because I thought the movie was entertaining at Cannes, just like Sperling. A lot of other people were naysayers and made me sort of doubt myself. But, you know, his movies almost all make $30 to $70 million. I felt certain this would do at least, you know, at the high end of that. And it looks like it's going to be his biggest hit yet.
Okay, I will probably see it. But, you know, speaking of Final Destination, this is horrible, and everyone's going to write in and say what a horrible – I mean, Final Destination, right? The Final Destination?
Yeah.
Okay, people are going to write in and say that I'm, like, really sick, but somebody pointed out to me that the death of DJ AM was kind of like Final Destination.
How did he die?
First off, why don't you explain who DJ AM is for our audience?
DJ AM was the DJ who was kind of better known for the women that he dated, i.e. Nicole Richie and Mandy Moore, than he was for, like, being a DJ. But he was in the L.A. area, at least, and I think all over the country, you know, pretty well known for what he did. But he was the guy who was in the plane crash with Travis Barker from Blink 182, like, a year ago.
Right. Yeah.
And that they were, like, the only survivors of that plane crash.
Yeah, so no better way to you know, live your life after a plane crash than to kill yourself less than a year later.
Isn't that bizarre?
It's very sad.
Well, I'm sure he didn't mean to overdose, but...
Oh, he OD'd on drugs? It wasn't an intentional suicide?
Correct.
Well, I don't think we know all the facts yet, but that would be my guess, too. Yeah, it was unintentional.
I'll tell you, but I'm still, so out of really... it that on Friday, did not know who this guy was until he passed away. So that
How could you not know who he is? That's because you don't read Us Weekly.
I do not.
Yeah, I don't know who he was either. I don't know much about relationship stuff. If he'd made a good movie or album or something, I might have heard of him. But when it's just they're famous for who they date, it goes right past me.
You guys, that's pathetic.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Well, maybe if I lived in L.A. and heard him on the radio, I would know who he was.
No,
him on the radio. He's not on the radio. He's a DJ.
Like a club DJ.
Oh, a club DJ. Oh, I beg your pardon. I thought you meant a radio DJ. Okay. Well,
we don't have radio
enough,
DJs anymore, Michael.
You're right, actually.
Another filmmaker that had a good weekend was Neil Blomkamp, who made District...
Ooh, say it again, just like that, Sperling.
Neil Blomkamp. I can say his name. He directed District 9, of course. $10.7 million came in fourth place in its third week in release, and it dropped 41%. It was on 3,100 screens here in the United States and Canada. So not doing too badly. It's made $90 million so far.
Despite the fact that I panned it?
Yes, pretty much.
This is very surprising.
But making $100 million as it will, that's a great accomplishment for that movie.
Yeah, and Julie and Julia, which came in sixth place, with $7.4 million, only dropped 15.9%, which is not bad.
I still have no desire to see that, and I'm the audience, I think. So that's...
Well, it's definitely adults, and they take a while to get to the movies. That's why, and it's Meryl Streep, so it's definitely showing good legs. I'm not surprised at all, even though I was not a fan of half of the movie. I liked the Julia half, but not the Julie. The
Wait a second, let me get
stuff.
This straight. You just said Meryl Streep has good legs?
Yes, absolutely.
I didn't want to say anything, but yeah, that's what you
that was
said.
It was intentional. It was Meryl Streep has good legs. She has a lot of her movies will play well because she appeals to a broad, older audience, and they don't rush out opening weekend. And there are people are liking the movie. I think everything with the blogger is insufferable, but everything in France with Julia Childs is charming. It's very funny. If the whole movie had been that, I think it would be really fun. But, you know, my mom saw it. She loved it. And, you know, it should make my plus. She's coming off the biggest hit of her career. I mean, Mamma Mia made well, a huge amount of money worldwide. It's the biggest hit of all time in the UK. So, you know, it's probably going to do well overseas as well.
On 909 screens, 500 Days of Summer made $2 million over the weekend.
And I'm so happy because this movie's really had legs. It's consistently made $2 million, $2 to $3 million for the last like 3 or 4 weeks in a row. It keeps chugging along. It only dropped 9%. It's gotten great word of mouth. It's going to make at least $30 to $40 million on DVD, I bet, because everyone's going to want to see it again or, you know,
it appeals to a lot of demographics.
What is it with you and legs?
Yeah.
Today.
What is it with you and legs today?
I can't help it. I can't help it.
Well, a movie we skipped over is Halloween 2, which came in third place this week in North America. It made $17.4 million on just over 3,000 screens in its first week in release. And Rob Zombie looks like he's going to be doing a remake of yet another horror movie, The Blob. Was that a guffaw? Was that an
initial? It was a guffaw.
Or
I wanted to be quiet so we could hear the crickets for a minute, but it's just, I suppose you can redo it and make something out of it, but it seems like a really dumb idea to remake The Blob. But he insists it won't be blob-like at all. Don't look for the jello mold character that hovered in the background while Steve McQueen pointed at it and screamed, because it's not going to be like that in the least.
Right. Well, that film was Steve McQueen's breakout role in 1958.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now there's a part of me, though, that thinks, like, well, good for Rob Zombie. I mean, I kind of think it's cool that he's made sort of a name for himself as a director of, you know, C-level schlock, but...
No, I agree.
Wait a second. He hasn't made a name for himself. He remade somebody else's name under his
own. No, but this isn't... It's not like this is the first movie he's ever directed. I mean, this is what he does. He's kind of creating a brand for directing remakes of C-level horror movies. And he does a decent job, from what I understand. I would never, ever go see any of those, but from what I understand, he does a decent job.
Yeah, no, he's definitely got credibility. And Dee Snider of Twisted Sister, he was doing the same thing. He made Strangeland, which was a huge hit in Germany, but, you know, made money and sort of was sort of working in the same genre, sort of hardcore horror movie. And Rob Zombie has definitely taken it to a really high level. I'm sure he's going to get, you know, bigger and bigger properties. You know, he's proven he can bring it in on time, under budget, make money. And, you know, he's going to branch out from these remakes into original stuff. And
exactly. You know,
yeah, he's doing good for him.
That's what I think, you know. And, you know, when you get to a certain age where you can't be like, you know, Rob Zombie anymore and you've got to start doing something else that actually uses your brain, then, you know, kudos to him.
Well, maybe Disney can hire him then to direct one of the Marvel films that will no doubt be made by them now that they bought Marvel Comics for $4 billion earlier today, which means that all of the comic books that I've been saving for years in my closet are actually worth something.
and they'll all include Scrooge McDuck in cameo appearances from now on.
Woohoo!
Is he? That would actually be funny.
Yeah, a little crossover. And actually, there's the movie Postgrad with Alexis Bledel includes a not Postgrad. No, I beg your pardon. It's Whit Stillman's film, The Last Days of Disco. I just watched it on DVD for the first time. It came out this week on DVD on the Criterion Collection. And there's a Scrooge McDuck reference. Robert Sean Leonard's a big Scrooge McDuck collector. I'm sorry to get you off topic. Do you think this is a smart buy, Sperling?
Scrooge McDuck comics, never.
What about, well, I don't know. If you focus your collection, it's a good idea. But what about Disney buying Marvel?
Disney buying Marvel? I mean, I think it's a brilliant idea. They're basically taking a competitor off the market. Marvel was out there making their own movies. They were going to be financing a third of all of their future movies on their own. And of course, one of the reasons for this deal happening is they need the money to go and finance their own movies. And of course, this is really bad news for Paramount and 20th Century Fox, both of whom have franchises based on Marvel comic book heroes. The X-Men.
Yeah, how's this going to work out?
Well, Paramount
they
says,
keep them.
Yeah, Paramount says they're in no danger of losing the Iron Man franchise to Disney because they have a contract in place, and Fox says the same thing.
But, you know, 20, 30, 40 years from now, when they want to make a new Iron Man or a new Spider-Man, it will have reverted back to Disney and they'll get the next go around. You know, long term, you know, the characters will all be Disney based.
And that's what scares me, actually. The thing that I find the most alarming about this piece of news is what it means for us as the fans.
Well, Disney's always very good to the fans. I mean, just you know, I think it's next
week
or the week
Disney's
after.
Yeah, but Disney, that they scare me. They're like taking over the world.
Sperlin, you referred to this deal as brilliant. And I would say it's obvious. I would have said 10 years ago, 15 years ago would have been brilliant when Marvel was moribund and nobody was paying attention to it. And you could have picked this up for a couple hundred million, literally, easily. And everybody would have been thrilled, and you could have leveraged all those properties and made these movies and drawn on all these characters. But instead, they're buying Marvel at their peak. You know, they're paying top dollar. They're buying at the top of the market for Marvel. I think it's a good deal long term because it helps them populate their park and reach out to teenage boys, and they can do rides and they can do TV shows and animated series and all that sort of stuff. But it's not exactly brilliant, because brilliant would have been 15 years ago saying, you know what, Spider-Man and Hulk and Iron Man, these are really good properties and we can make something of them, because Marvel was dead 15 years ago. Today, Marvel is hotter than ever. Everybody wants to do business with them.
That's yeah, right. Now it's an obvious choice, whereas, 10 years ago, it would have shown some foresight.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, and they're going to have to wait years for these deals to expire to actually get their hands on, you know, a movie version of Spider-Man and X-Men and Thor. These are all locked in place for, you know, a good 10, 15 years. So it's but I think it's smart. They bought the Muppets many years ago, and it was a couple hundred million. I remember saying to my brother, they can't overpay for the Muppets. It's such it's such a thing that Disney can leverage better than anyone else. It's worth more to them. Actual characters that you can populate in a park and appeal to families and build rides around, those are really, really hard to create on your own. And no better way to buy market share than to buy the Hulk.
I'm just so scared for what this means for us. I really am.
You know what was funny was watching Robert Iger on all these talk shows this morning talk about this deal. And he's sitting, obviously he's doing a satellite press tour. He's sitting in front of the same background every single time. And there is on the background written in large lettering is Walt Disney Company. And then in a little red box underneath it, Marvel.
Exactly. Oh, see?
It's already started.
See, it's what I'm talking about.
Well, you know what it is? It's that Robert Iger was in San Diego a couple weeks ago, saw Comic-Con and went, wow, this is a huge hit. Somebody get me a comic book company. I don't care which one. It's so popular.
That's literally probably how it happened. That's how.
Yeah, we laugh, but I'm sure that's exactly how it happened.
Well, you know, next week, Disney is holding their own version of Comic-Con just for their fans. So it's just Disney fans and about Disney content and Disney properties in Anaheim. It's called D23, the Disney's D23 Expo.
I find this so incredibly frightening. Explain it for everybody.
It's a 4-day event next month in Anaheim that will celebrate and sell all things Disney with celebrity appearances and slick sneak previews of upcoming films, television shows, and theme park attractions.
Will you be there, Sperlin?
You guys, Disney is taking over the world. Why are we not worried about this?
Disney definitely knows how to keep its fans engaged. They're doing a better and better job all the time. One of my favorite sites to talk about Disney is Jim Hill Media. I sent the link to Sperlin, but jimhillmedia.com. Those are just a site where you can get an idea of how obsessed and focused people are on all Disney properties. I mean, these people know about, you know, early episodes of the Disney TV series. They know about the watches. They know about the T-shirts. They know about the rides. And they are focused like a laser on every element of the Disney empire. And they are so invested in how it's treated and what they do and how they interact and how they work with each other. It's kind of crazy. It makes fans of, you know, Dungeons and Dragons look tiresome and boring and unimaginative in comparison.
No, I think it's brilliant. I think the Disney people are brilliant. Don't get me wrong. I just it sort of scares me. Any kind of level of fandom like this really just strikes me as unnatural.
Robert Iger calls those fans Uber fans, and he says, we live in a world where digital communication enables people to express their opinions about things to a much broader set of people. We call it the combustion of digital word of mouth. Their ability to communicate with others is unlike anything we've seen at any time before. What he didn't say in that quote were the words Twitter or Facebook. So, not bad. He was able to say all of that.
He didn't say Showbiz Sandbox either, which he should
that's
have.
That's true. He should have, yes. He should have.
See, that's what I'm talking about.
He should invite us to D23 so that we can go hang out with Kevin Burke, a 44-year-old Disney-phile living in Papillon, Nebraska. He says
Say that again?
Papillon. Yes, this is the show of...
Butterfly, Nebraska?
Butterfly, Nebraska. Yeah, that's what it... Butterfly in French. Burke says, If I was ever to run into Julie Andrews, I told my wife that's the one person I'd probably faint in front of. It's going to be 8 a.m. to midnight for 4 days. You have to pace yourself a little bit. Sugar and caffeine will only carry you so far.
I think that's funny, actually. I should probably be a little scared about that, but I think it's really kind of funny.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's, you know, as long as he's not wearing Mickey Mouse ears to bed, I think it's fine. You got a hobby, you're like into it. There's a lot to be said for it. But as Karen points out, Disney owns ESPN. They own Pixar, the greatest animated filmmakers of the past 15 years. They own The Muppets. They own Marvel Comics. They own ABC. They are slowly taking over the world.
Well, yeah, and guys, I'd really like to continue the podcast today, but I'm just going to go fill out an application for work over there.
You want to become a cast member?
Yes, I want to become a cast member.
I thought you were gonna take off time to go play Xbox. Tell us about that, Sperling. I know you'd be doing that soon.
Well, that's really why I need to take some time off, because Megan Fox, who stars in Transformers, although I wouldn't say she necessarily starred in it so much as she was dragged through the movie by Shia LaBeouf as a, like, you know, female toy. I don't know what you would call her in that film. Her character
female
was...
toy. It's probably about accurate.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, she is playing Xbox, or she played Xbox yesterday at 3 p.m. Pacific time. She played Xbox Live with all of the people that were on Xbox Live who subscribed to that service. She played, I guess, the video game based on the Transformers movie. But she's apparently rumored to be a huge video game nut.
Did it crash with all the
traffic? She probably just wanted to position herself as a huge video game nut.
She is a nut, is what you're saying.
I said no such thing.
It's okay. You're on nuts and Michael's on legs. Wait, that could be taken the wrong way.
I'm no longer saying anything bad about Disney or any of its properties. I am a Disney bot.
The views of our hosts are not necessarily the views.
Exactly.
So that's pretty much the end of that story. Xbox servers apparently did just fine. Either that or nobody really cared that Megan Fox was on it.
Well, I'm sure when Transformers Revenge of the Fallen comes out on DVD, it'll be a big hit, even though the movie was terrible and I don't think anybody really liked it. On the other hand, a new movie that just came out on DVD this week is Julia Roberts' Duplicity.
You wrote a story on that, didn't you?
Yeah, we're going to include it in the show notes.
You wrote a post on that on the Huffington Post.
I certainly did. I love the movie. I think it's one of the best of the year. Have either of you seen it?
I saw it, and I really liked it. It's Tony Gilroy's second film as a writer-director. His first film was Michael Clayton, and of course he's written other films like The Devil's Advocate.
And The Cutting Edge. Swoon!
And The Bourne trilogy. He's written or co-written or been involved in the screenplays for the Bourne movies.
Yeah, I mean, he's a great writer with great, you know, great narrative sense and great dialogue. And this is another example of that.
Yeah, I loved Michael Clayton. I got a ton of Oscar nominations. It was a good hit. It starred George Clooney. And that was one of my favorites of that year. And this movie is a lot more playful. It's very sexy and fun. Julia Roberts and Clive Owen play corporate spies for competing companies that are trying to get the formula for a new moisturizer. And they're either conning each other for their employer, or they're both working together to con their own employers, or they're conning their employers and each other to try and steal everything for themselves. And it's a very fun, playful, sexy, smart adult caper film. And I really like
it. I couldn't bring myself to see this. I took one look at the trailer and I'm like, that's going to be a Netflix. I just don't want to pay money to see her. I should love her. I should be a huge fan of Pretty Woman. I'm not. As soon as I saw her and her Julia Robertsness in that trailer, I was like, you cannot make me go see that movie. I love Clive Owen. I would see it for him, but so I just didn't know if I could sit through her.
You won't see anything with Julia Roberts in it? You're really just not a fan?
I cannot stand her.
Oh, well, you're certainly alone in that, I would say. She certainly has a huge track record of successful films. And really, this movie got good reviews, not as good as I expected, but it got good reviews. It's practically her lowest scoring movie since the early 90s. And Mary Riley, which was a dreadful film with dreadful reviews, and I Love Trouble with Nick Nolte. You have to go that far back to find a movie that scored less at the box office than Duplicity. And I have no idea what happened or why, but you know, her movies make $60, $80, $100, $120 million, $180 million again and again and again. And for some reason, this movie did not get any traction, though I hope people will discover it on video.
It was very good, and I thought Clive Owen was fantastic in it. I mean, that line where he says, names I forget. Faces I'm not so good with, but I'm getting better. People I've screwed, I remember.
I don't think any of that didn't come across in the trailer. The trailer, I thought, made the movie look boring. Yeah.
The one thing I thought that was interesting about the movie was when I went back to see what it opened up against and the movies that were playing at the box office, because it opened in March, which it should have had the field open to itself. It's an adult film. It's smart. It's sexy. It has, you know, Julia Roberts. And I wanted to see what it was up against. And, you know, I looked at the top 50 movies, and they almost all of them made more money than Duplicity. And when you talk about the box office and how it's doing, pretty good sign in March when you've got movies that are making so much money, like Knowing with Nicolas Cage made $80 million totally, you know, at the end of its run. I Love You, Man ended up making $71 million. Watchmen made $107 million. Taken, the Liam Neeson film, made $145 million. Slumdog Millionaire made $141 million. Madea Goes to Jail made $90 million. Paul Blart, Mall Cop, $146 million. He's Just Not That Into You, $93 million. Gran Torino, $148 million. That's a heck of a list of movies opening, you know, playing on theaters in March that really did well based on their budget and how much money they cost to make and market. You know, that's a lot of successful movies.
That's a slanted look, because Gran Torino was pretty much coming off of screens in March.
I'm just listing the that's not slanted. I'm just listing the top 15 films that were at the box office the weekend Duplicity opened. Some of them were carryovers from Christmas, but these are the movies that were still playing in theaters. I didn't even list them all. Race to Witch Mountain made $67 million. It's just, you know, the only two movies that made less money ultimately at the box office than Duplicity were The Last House on the Left, a remake with no names in it, and something called Fired Up, which was a no-name teen comedy that made $17 million. So
I think I saw that.
Oh, so that you liked.
So 12 out of 15 movies at the box office that weekend, the top 15 movies, made more money than Duplicity. And a lot of them were very successful ones.
It was a very good movie. I really liked it, and had lots of good twists and turns, and kept you on the edge of your seat. And especially at the end, when you guys were supposed to stop. I mean,
I bet it'll do well. It'll find a good audience, and it should, you know, help Tony Gilroy. I hope it doesn't hold him back, because he's definitely an interesting, smart director. And of course, he's white and middle aged and male, which, as Sperling pointed out, is very typical for Hollywood, isn't it?
I pointed that out.
In the show notes, you linked to the New York Times article.
Put it in the show notes.
Okay.
Everybody in Hollywood who's a director is white and male and old.
I didn't point that out. It was Michael Seipley, a writer for the New York Times, as we often say here. We must put one story per week on our list that is written by Michael Seipley of the New York Times. But yes, he wrote a story last week that says, "See any similarities in these directors? If you are splashing around with a bunch of guys who are 93% white, an average of 45.62 years old, and look as if they've done this before, you must be swimming in the studio director's pool. Such is the profile of studio filmmakers based on a survey of those who directed the 85 or so live-action movies that have been released or will be in 2009 by six of the biggest film companies."
I'm thinking maybe Michael Seipley just didn't have anything else to write about. How is this news? Why talk about this now?
Because it's August, and unless Disney starts buying up big comic book companies, buying up other big comic book companies, you know, there's usually very little entertainment news to talk about at the end of August. And until this week, that was true.
And it's been true for a long time, but it didn't used to be. In the old days, in the 20s and 30s, women wrote a majority of the screenplays and were directing movies all over the place. So it really, they dropped the hammer and it changed, and it hasn't changed since the 30s. But there was, once upon a time, women were equal draws in Hollywood and were able to direct films.
And so why do you think that changed?
I don't know what happened. They made fewer movies
Men learned to type. That's what happened. Men learned to type. That's what happened.
I don't know what that means, but it's funny.
Well, because the screenwriters were all women because they typed and.
Oh, I thought you meant secretaries. You're right. Yeah, no, it was. I don't know. I've never heard an explanation of why women fell out. They were editing. They were directing. They were writing in the silent era and the early sound era, and then suddenly the bottom dropped out of it, and men took over.
I know. I wonder if that has something to do with the code.
What code?
Pre-code movies when there was more.
Yeah.
I had a feeling that's
what
you were
talking about. They were
friendlier
towards women and sex, and it was a little bit more open. And then, you know, after that, which was probably what, late 40s, early 50s, maybe a little bit later than that. And then movies started to become a little bit more, you know, women had to go back into their place. And maybe that was true behind the scenes as well.
Well, I know, Karen, you're going to be really interested in this next statistic that was mentioned in the article as a former agency brat like myself. It says, of those who have agents, 74% of the male directors are represented either by the Creative Artists Agency or by William Morris Endeavor Entertainment. By my count, Creative Artists space outpaces William Morris Endeavor 35 to 26, so says Michael Siepley. I thought that was interesting. 74% of the filmmakers represented by CAA. That's a, and William Morris. That's a lot.
Well, it is and it isn't. I mean, when you think about how they like to package movies these days, it really kind of behooves them to have them kind of all in one place, doesn't it?
Well, not if you're a filmmaker and you're trying to get a movie and CAA is pitching some other director.
Well, yeah, but if you are a filmmaker and you want to get Brad Pitt in your movie, it definitely helps to be at CAA.
I'm surprised it's not a little bit higher. That means one out of four directors are not represented by CAA or William Morris. That seems like a lot to me, actually. It's you're right that they dominate the market, but it's not quite as dire as I thought it might be.
Well, that's because those one are the women who are represented at, you know, Gersh.
Innovative.
And one might,
ICM.
And one of those women might be Vicky Jensen, who directed Postgrad, which just came out 2 weeks ago and unfortunately was a flop at the box office. So
I've
that
got
didn't
to see this movie.
What did you think of it, the Alexis
No,
Bledel
I haven't seen it yet. I've got to find time this week to go see it. Huh? I'm determined before it leaves.
I don't recommend it, but I like Alexis Bledel and I like Zach Guilford, who plays the stuttering quarterback on the TV show Friday Night Lights.
He's
and,
great.
They're the only reason, yeah, there's the only reason to see it. It's not an interesting or original film.
Okay, it's a little derivative, but I'm a big fan of these types of movies. I'm a cheese ball. What can I say? Sometimes when you go see these, you find a band slam.
That's right. This is no mm-hmm. band slam, but you're right.
And sometimes you find a Plan 9 from outer space. Well, now, what is it when you're derivative of yourself? When you're copying yourself?
Please tell me that you're segueing into the Oasis story right now.
And if I weren't? Yes, I am, because Noel Gallagher is copying himself by once again quitting his rock band. Except this time he did it in an interesting way. His band Oasis was supposed to be on stage at a music festival in Paris. And I guess they flashed a message on the screen to the crowd that was waiting to see them that said, as a result of an altercation within the band, the Oasis gig has been canceled.
I hope somebody stole that sign, because that's probably worth nothing, because they probably posted so much. The funniest thing about this news story is that it's not news.
Kind of like the women directors, what you're saying.
Yeah, kind of like, yeah. I thought it was hysterical when you posted this on show notes. I'm like, what? Really? We're going to talk about this? Okay, we're done.
I'll give anyone 10-to-1 odds that Oasis plays together again in the next 10 years.
If yeah, 10 Oasis, years. I mean, that's all
on Liam.
10
I mean,
years, 10 minutes. And then we'll be talking about this again in like October. Oh, yeah, Noel Gallagher left Oasis again.
He's always storming off in some huff. Oh, this is bollocks.
Yeah.
My brother's bollocks.
It's a long tradition of fighting bands, like the Everly Brothers fought all the time. Simon and Garfunkel, Richard and Linda Thompson, one of my favorite British folk rock acts.
And then, of course, there was always Peter, Paul, and Mary.
Oh, they used to fight like mad backstage.
The Carpenters.
why can't they all get along like Chris Allen and Adam Lambert? The two American Idol finalists have announced that their albums, their debut albums, will both come out on the same day, November 17th.
And ironically, you know, we talked earlier about what one of the benefits was for Disney to buy Marvel. And one of the benefits is when 20th Century Fox wants to go out and release their next X-Men movie, Disney could say, well, that's a Marvel property. And you know what? We're going to release our movie on that day. Now you have Chris Allen and Adam Lambert, who are at the same record company. And the same record company is releasing both of those albums on the same day.
That's really strange. Don't you think that's a little odd?
Yes.
No, I think it's I think it's fine. They used to think, oh, it'd be so embarrassing to have them compete with each other. One of them's going to sell more. On the other hand, if you can get them to come into the store for one of them, you might just get that impulse buy to buy the other one. They've all got a lot of fans. They get along. They're touring together right now with the Idol people. And I think it's just sort of a, hey, it's no big deal. We're happy to do it. You know, we're both rooting each other on. And, you know, hey, it's Idol Day at the record store. Go in and buy, you know, one or both of their new albums. It brings attention to both of them. I think it's a smart thing, a friendly thing. And, of course, there'll be the horse race of who sells more copies. But I don't think it's a, I don't think it's strange at all. I think it's a smart move, especially in this day and age when you have to do anything you can to bring attention to your release.
Well, and it's not like Chris Allen and Adam Lambert have the same fans. You're right.
Yeah. Well, I'll buy both albums.
Well, yeah, because you're an American Idol fan. But, like, right. In terms of music, the type of music they make.
Exactly.
It'll be
They're
very
not competing with
I
each
think.
Other.
You mean bad music?
Careful.
I think that's debatable. I think that if you're – no, we can laugh. But seriously, if you're like a Jack Johnson fan, you'll probably like whatever Chris Allen puts out.
Exactly. And if you're a Micah fan or a Queen fan, you might like Adam Lambert.
Yeah, I'm curious to know what he'd put out. I don't think I'd buy it, but if you told me it was good, I would.
Well, I think that the record company should have just come out and said, we are trying to get both of these albums in stores before Black Friday, before everybody races to the record stores, or the Walmarts, to purchase albums on, you know, for Christmas. They obviously wanted to release them this year before Christmas for the holiday season, well, which is fine. That's their.
They always do. They always do. They always get them out as soon as possible. That's nothing new.
Yeah, because they want to make sure that we don't forget who they are.
Yeah, they want them out now before the next season begins in January.
I've already forgotten who they are.
How can you possibly?
Adam Lambert came out on the cover of Rolling Stone? What more does he have to do?
He's so sexy. I wish he played for my team.
You know, there's a funny item about Rolling Stone online. Jan Wenner has woken up to the idea of the internets. And they're suddenly, they had been farming out the control of their website to somebody else. And they're finally going to take back control of it and see if they can make something of this. You know, they should have been a central site for people to lock, talk about and hear music and get downloads of new albums. But they never even tried. And now I think, the horse has already left the barn along with the cow and the chicken. And I don't, you know, it's just way too late in the day for them to try and establish Rolling Stone as some central site for music online. But, you know, they have a great name. But, boy, talk about being, you know, a day late and a dollar short.
I know. You have Paste. You have
Rhapsody.
Rhapsody, Pitchfork. I mean, there's Napster. I mean, there's so many different websites that you can go to now for music news. There's no reason to turn to Rolling Stone for anything.
No.
And they never tried, which is what was so bizarre.
Well, that isn't the first case of a mainstream media outlet not understanding the internets. Or the by the way, did they say that it was, you know, a series of tubes? You can't just, you know, fill them. Well, since we're on music and we're talking about pop stars, I guess we have to talk about Michael Jackson and what the Los Angeles Police Department ruled this week, that his death was a homicide. So as you mentioned at the top of the show, Michael, Dr. Conrad Murray is in a lot of trouble. And if I were him, I'd just, you know, go directly to jail. Do not pass go.
Yeah, but can we talk about the fact that homicide? I mean, come on, really?
That's what
manslaughter, maybe, but homicide?
Well, isn't it classified as a homicide
it's a homicide no matter what level it is. Manslaughter is homicide. It's all homicide. It's not necessarily murder one.
Okay, because when they start talking about, you know, that they're classifying it as a homicide, I mean, it sounds like premeditated. I mean, I don't think that was the case at all. I just don't think he had any, you know, balls to say no.
Did anybody have balls to say no to Michael Jackson? Can we say balls on a podcast?
I think you can.
Okay.
I think Murray is definitely sort of, you know, the unlucky guy who was there when the game of musical chairs ended. There have been a lot of doctors involved with Michael Jackson over the years who've enabled him. And Michael Jackson is responsible for his own addictions. But you can't you can't give somebody anesthesia that's used for surgery. You can't just decide to do that. It's, you know, it's not allowed. You can't just give them anesthesia just so they can go to sleep at night. It's incredibly dangerous. And he lied to the cops. He said he was only away for 2 minutes, and in fact, he was probably gone for at least 45 minutes to an hour because he was on his cell phone. And, you know, you just can't put somebody under and then walk away. It's just completely reckless, medically speaking. It doesn't matter how famous the guy is or how many other people did it before you. I'm sorry, but you're going to pay the price when you're there when he dies.
Well, propofol is a very powerful anesthetic, and it is used, as you mentioned, Michael, to put patients to sleep in the operating room so that they can be intubated and their surgery can take place. The problem with propofol is that an anesthesiologist has to administer it and stick around because it reduces the lung's ability to contract. It's basically just turning off all of the muscle responses to stimuli and to the nervous system. So you have most people are on ventilators when they are put on propofol. So for him to just walk out of the room, if that's what indeed what happened, I mean, it's just not a drug to be used the way and administered the way Murray was doing in that. The way Dr. Murray was.
Yeah, I mean, when you go to hospital and go into surgery, the most dangerous part of most surgeries is the anesthesia. It's not the cutting open of the stomach. It's not the removal of this or the patching of that. It's going under the anesthesia. They have the highest medical malpractice insurance coverage. It's the most dangerous part of every surgery. Anesthesia is really the one that can get complicated the quickest, create the most problems, and you know that's going to bite Murray in the ass.
No, but I agree with you. It's just he just happened to be the guy.
Well,
he
think
lost.
About it.
Yeah, but he happened to be the latest guy to behave incredibly irresponsibly and ignore basic medical procedures. Yes.
Well, and he was being paid $150,000 a month. Do you know how much money that is for a doctor? That's a lot of money. I don't care what kind.
Even
of
for a doctor. I love that Michael called it his milk because propofol is milky colored, and so he calls it his milk. I want my milk. It's the guy who talks about Jesus juice and milk. I mean, the number of terms that he comes up with is just, it's perfect.
Well, and now he's saying, Dr. Conrad Murray, that is saying, well, yeah, he gave him Valium and an anti-anxiety drug, lorazepam, and he gave him all this medication. None of it was working. So then he gave him propofol because that's not going to interact with any of the drugs that you've previously given him. Well, I'm not a doctor, nor do I play one on TV, but this all sounds quite unresponsible. Irresponsible.
Unresponsible. Unresponsible indeed. In fact, that's a Paula Abdulism, perhaps.
Ooh, we are just like, we are on fire with these transitions.
Moving on
today.
To the next story.
But you know, we should have transitioned into the fact that his family is now doing an A&E reality show, the Jackson family, that is.
Ugh.
That's so frightening. Joe Jackson has got to be behind this, right?
I don't know. I thought he was starting a record company. Didn't you hear? He's starting a record company. I mean,
yeah,
he's got
starting
his own
a record company. Did you know that?
I mean, the guy's on TV every 5 minutes telling people that he's got a record company. Oh, my son died, but I got a record company.
But I saw nothing in the notice about this. But I'm certain Janet is not going to be involved in this. She's not going to be hanging around on a reality series on A&E.
Highly
so
unlikely.
We're talking about Tito and I don't know Latoya,
Jermaine.
Marlon, and
Marlon. What is? It's not Finding
it's
Nemo.
It's just tacky and sad, I think.
Well, A&E ordered the Jackson Family series. I think they've already shot like the 1 hour opening for it, the pilot.
Right. It was gonna be a documentary, and then they're turning it into a reality series.
Right. And you know who broke this news was Roger Friedman, our good friend from the Showbiz 411 blog.
Go there every day.
Yeah, he broke this news, and I guess well, you know, if A&E can do it right, it could prove to be a very valuable tool for teaching people the effects of drug addiction and the consequences of drug addiction.
Yeah, that's a nice try. Do you think people will watch this? Because I do.
I'm sorry, I missed what you said because I was busy thumbing through my TiVo listings trying to find out when it's on and recording.
Do you think people will watch this? Because I definitely do.
That was a joke. That was
I liked it.
Sorry,
I liked it.
It was. I missed it.
I think it'll get a little attention. I don't know if it's a good fit for A&E. You know, I always question the cable channels. I suppose any sort of hit is good, but when you have a hit show that is so far afield of what you're known for and what you should be doing, to me, it doesn't sort of rebound back to your channel and get people to come back for the other stuff. Just like it just you know, A&E, the Arts and Entertainment Channel, suddenly they've got a Jackson reality show. What other A&E shows is that going to draw people to? It just, it doesn't make a good fit for me. It works on MTV. It works on VH1 even better. It works on BET. A&E to me, it's a weird fit.
Wait a second. It doesn't work on VH1. Watch this, Karen. You ready?
Yeah.
Let's take note of this transition. It doesn't work on VH1 because all they run is reality shows about relationships. Or at least that's what they used to run. Because,
nice segue.
Exactly. And watch how I segue back to something else that Karen mentioned earlier. So VH1 has been running all of these reality shows called, you know, I don't know, Love, 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 I Love Money 3, You Love Me, I Love You. I don't even know what some of these shows are called. But
isn't Megan Loves for Millionaire or whatever?
Megan Wants a Millionaire. So
no love in that title?
No love. No love.
Huh. She doesn't love a millionaire. She just wants one.
Yes, correct. And the LA Times says VH1 wants less love and more redemption. And that's probably because, as I mentioned last week, it turns out that one of the cast members, I don't know what you'd call them, the contestants, the people.
Players?
Participants
on one of their shows, I believe it was Megan Wants a Millionaire, Two of their shows, that's right, because he was good enough to get on twice, even though he had a record in Canada, and wound up killing his wife here in the United States, and dumping her body in a suitcase somewhere in, I think it was Downey, California. Then he escapes to Canada and hangs himself in a hotel just outside of Vancouver, and now Tom Calderone, the president of VH1, is saying that he does not want to be the network that is known or famous for this.
I don't think these stories are connected, really. I mean, VH1 has been driving the flavor of love genre into the ground for the last 3 years, and now they know they have to do something different, just like MTV did Real World, you know, ad infinitum, and they just need to move on to something new. I don't think it's because of this one, you know, glitch with this, you know, terrible tragedy in people's personal lives that sort of affected two of their shows.
It's all fun and games until somebody winds up dead in a suitcase.
Nice, and I'm the mean one.
Well, is Paula Abdul's career dead? That's what I'd like to know.
Oh, you stole my segue, because I was going to go from the VH1 to say, well, you know, they've already started their transition away from reality, sort of, by having Paula Abdul host VH1 Divas, because that is a huge career step for her after dropping out of American Idol to go host a one-off VH1 Divas, which will air Thursday, September 17th. And I guess it's going to star Miley Cyrus, Leona Lewis, and Adele, along with Kelly Clarkson and Jordan Sparks.
Those are big names. Those are some of the, you know, top female acts around right now.
Miley Cyrus, Adele, I've got no idea who Adele is, or Leona Lewis.
Yeah, who's Adele?
Adele, I believe, won the Grammy for Best Newcomer of the Year, didn't she?
Oh, yes, she's quite good.
Yeah, and Leona Lewis was the top-selling female artist of the world last year. She sold 6 million copies of her debut album. She won the UK equivalent of American Idol called The X Factor. And, you know, Oprah had her on her show. Her debut album did very, very well worldwide, 6 million copies. And this is her new follow-up album is just about to come out.
Was she dating DJ AM? Because I've got no idea who she is.
Oh, she's a big, big worldwide star. She had success in the U.S. She sold, I think, 2 million copies, but she can get even bigger. She's got a great voice. She's beautiful. She's very much in the Mariah Carey, Whitney Houston vein.
Well, speaking of getting bigger and speaking of divas, Paula Abdul was negotiating to star on Ugly Betty, but the producers said, thanks, but no thanks. You're a diva. We're not giving you your own private jet. At least that's...
Is that what she asked for?
Apparently. Now, again, this is not confirmed, but between ABC and her manager, who is getting more press than Paula Abdul, it seems, she was not able to work anything out with to appear on the show. And actually, do you know who's going to replace her?
Kristen Johnson.
Kristen Johnson, that's right. That was a that
who
was
I think
a
is pop, fantastic.
Pop quiz.
Yeah, I read the show notes. I know.
Yeah, Kristen Johnson from Third Rock from the Sun is going to play Amanda's nemesis. She's older than Amanda by 10 years. She's still trying to get into rich, all the right clubs, wearing tight dresses. Tragic, I think.
Well, I love Kristen Johnson's quote. I've always considered myself a poor man's Paula Abdul.
She was on Third Rock from the Sun with Joseph Gordon-Levitt, who we love from 500 Days of Summer. And I think this is a real shame for Paula Abdul. It would have been a nice, you know, easy thing for her to do. That would have brought her a lot of attention. I don't know what went wrong, but that's
well,
it's not a good
song.
It,
part of it might have had to do with the fact that Paula is based in L.A. and everything that she shoots. Well, everything that she shoots. But, you know, most of the work she does is here in L.A. And Ugly Betty shoots in New York. It's sort of a pain.
You just moved to New York. You're right. Like last season, didn't it?
Yeah.
And the only way she can get there, because no other planes land in New York, is to have ABC hire a private jet.
But you know what? That might be more for scheduling issues rather than privacy issues.
Yeah. That's my sister and her husband ride a private jet. It's not that big a deal.
Wait,
it's not that much. It's not that insane a demand. She didn't say I want a private jet on 24-hour call. She might have just said when we need to shoot, you know, just get me on a private airport in and out of LA to New York. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
You know,
I'm still stuck on the fact that your sister and her husband fly in a private jet. Who the hell is your sister?
I said, you know what? I want to say something about that, but I know if I do, Karen
will
get off of it.
What the hell?
They're in the business world, and it's just, you know, in business, it's not that unusual. The time savings of, you know, this is why corporations have jets, because it is a huge hassle to get to an airport. You have to be there 2 hours beforehand or an hour and a half. You have to go through security, wait for the plane. You know, they don't have 5 hours of the day to waste just at the airport coming in and out. When you go to a private airport, they don't frisk you. They don't do all that stuff. You go on your plane. It takes off. You land. It's a different airport. It's quicker to get into the city. It saves you hours. And when you're flying into a city for a meeting, you don't have 3 or 4 hours to waste standing around at the airport. And
you want to just get on the plane and go.
Hey, it's very common in the business world, and I'm sure it's very common in Hollywood. So
yeah,
they described it
in Hollywood
on MSNBC as this ridiculous, insane demand. But I don't think it was. I don't know why it fell apart, but you know that.
I
doesn't
think
seem
people
like...
are just hopping on the Paula Abdul is a diva bandwagon.
Yeah.
Well, wait a second, Michael. Are your sister and brother-in-law corporate spies by any chance?
No, they are not.
Okay, just checking.
Is your sister Julia Roberts?
No, is she? Seriously.
Julie Roberts guilt.
Well, I was going to try and think of some snazzy segue to get into the fact that, you know, Jay Leno drives everywhere. He doesn't fly. But
that's good.
Yeah, there you go. There's
yeah,
my
that's
segue
good segue.
For that. Well, he announced his first week's guests last week. And it's unfortunate he couldn't get some of the A-listers, probably because they were all going to go on Conan, but... He got Tom Cruise, Robin Williams, Halle Berry, Miley Cyrus, Rihanna, Kanye West, and Eric Clapton because, you know, you just have to have, you know, one or two the big guests on every. And of course, he's got Jerry Seinfeld on the first episode, and Tom Cruise is going to come out and introduce a new segment called 10 at 10. Gee, I wonder if it's going to be a top 10 list.
That's terrible.
Yeah, all those guests? Yeah, I know. I wouldn't want to have a top
10. No, the 10 at 10 copying. That's.
But we don't know what
it's
going to be.
I don't know why that shocked me, but...
We have no idea what it's going to be.
Oh, come on. It's got to be some kind of a top 10 list. What else would it be?
10 things at 10 o'clock.
Yeah, 10 top 10 things.
Well, they could be the worst 10 things.
I am so not interested in watching this show in the slightest. I'm more interested now in seeing like what kind of numbers he gets.
I can't wait for it to come on. And you know why?
Why?
Because
why?
Once it's on, once this show finally airs...
We don't have to talk about it anymore?
Well, besides that, NBC will be forced to take that darn bug off their television network throughout 3 hours of prime time every night where that bug is in the lower right-hand corner saying, Jay Leno starts September 14th.
Yeah.
Okay, I clearly have not watched any NBC lately because I have not noticed that.
It's so annoying. It's bad enough that they have the network logo there all the time.
I do notice it on like Lifetime and Oxygen and ABC Family. Does that say a lot about me?
Oxygen is the worst. I was watching The Notebook yesterday. Okay, I only watched...
I saw that on the plane!
I only watched the first like 2 minutes of it, and I couldn't take my eyes off of it because they had like 15 different bugs advertising 70 different shows that they do on that network. And
no, I kept getting one show, just that one show, and I can't remember what it is now. That's how effective the bug was. I was just... Whenever I got to a boring part, I was like, that bug is so aggravating.
Well, and then there was, they have like people come dancing out from the side of the screen.
Oh, I hate that.
And there was this one cooking show. The woman must weigh 400 pounds. I have no
idea. Oh, I know what cooking show you're talking about. Yeah. Is that the one where it's like, you know, Love Your Kitchen or Guilt-Free Cooking or something like that?
Yes. I was like, guilt-free? I'd say so.
Yeah, fatty.
Unbelievable.
Nice. You better start feeling guilty.
Put the chalupa down.
Hey, at least she's dancing. It's only across my 13-inch screen, but she's dancing.
Try. Yeah. It is crazy when a third of the screen is literally covered with advertising. It's unbelievably irritating.
Yeah, I just want to watch my movie. People, please.
Well, I turned it off as soon as the bugs went away. I was kind
of
done.
You watched every moment of it and cried at the end with Ryan Gosling.
No, I watched the first like 4 minutes and I was like, wow, this is some really cheesy writing and acting.
No, that movie, I agree. I still watch it and I own it, but it is. It's really cheesy writing and cheesy acting.
It is cheesy, but it's directed by Nick Cassavetes, the son of John Cassavetes. And I've always argued that it was the most rebellious thing he could do. His father was the king of, you know, in-your-face, raw cinematic storytelling.
Nick did not want to rebel against his dad, not in the slightest. I bet you he took this movie because he wanted the challenge and he knew that it would be a commercial movie.
Didn't you used to represent Nick?
Or what? Yeah, no, I worked for his agent. Okay. And I almost worked for him on She's So Lovely, but the movie kept falling apart, so I eventually moved on. But he's a fantastic guy. Nothing made me happier than to see that this movie did well for him. But it's interesting that you see it as like possibly like rebelling against his dad, because you're right. It's interesting. But then, you know, he casts his mom in it, so just like he casts his mommy in everything.
It's just so antithetical to the movies his dad made. I found it funny. But I'm glad for Ryan Gosling. So, you know, more power to him.
Who's great in this? Who's really great in this? I think the end of the movie is less cheesy, I think, than the beginning.
Well, I only saw the first 4 minutes and we should be
discussing. It wasn't over. It still isn't over. Okay, moving
please
on.
Please tell me that's a line from the movie and you're not just...
It is. Okay. It is.
Well, did either of you see the trailer for Men Who Watch Goats?
Yes.
No.
I had no idea this. I mean, it looks kind of funny.
Yeah.
It's this Grant
Heston. Men Who Watch Goats? Wait, where was this in the show notes?
I'm just making it up. I'm pulling it out of my memory, but it wasn't in the show notes. But when I was reading the news this week, every single blog and newspaper talked about this, the trailer being released for Men Who Watch Goats, which is a George Clooney movie. And it actually looks halfway decent.
Can you tell me a little bit about it? Because I have no idea what we're talking about.
See, there are these goats, all right? And then they have men that watch them.
What?
That's the movie.
No, it's...
No? No? Okay.
The Men Who Stare at Goats is the name of the film.
I can't even get the name of the movie right? That's pretty pitiful.
It's based on a true story about a reporter in Iraq who stumbles on a U.S. Army unit that was involved in trying to use paranormal powers to complete their mission. The U.S. Army's had a history of trying to make ESP work and make, you know, hypnotizing crowds work. The CIA, they've been trying all this stuff for years. And this is a comedy playing off of one of these true stories about, you know, about some of these secret programs that the Army was using to try and come up with different weapons to fight the enemy or just confuse them. So it's sort of a black comedy about war and about the CIA and all that sort of stuff.
Kevin Spacey's in it. Jeff Bridges is in it. Ewan McGregor's in it.
It actually looks like fun. I saw a trailer, however, for the new Sandra Bullock movie called The Blind Side, which literally looked like the most painful thing I've ever seen in my entire life.
As opposed to the last movie that Sandra Bullock did? The
Proposal. Wait, is this the one that's got Bradley Cooper in it?
It does
What's
not
about?
Have Bradley Cooper. No, this is the one with she's a rich socialite in the South who adopts a giant black boy.
Is this ironic or is it serious? Is this like
Oscar? It's deadly serious and based on a true story and looks unbelievably painfully sentimental. It's just literally horrifying.
What was she thinking?
And that comes out after All About Steve, which is the Bradley Cooper movie you're talking about, where she stalks Bradley Cooper. That comes out
September. Oh, yeah. That looks painful too, but I'll still see it.
Yeah, that looks reasonable painful. It doesn't look like – that comes out September soon, September 4th. It comes out this Friday, doesn't it? As opposed to The Blind Side, which comes out in November and looks like Oscar bait, though not really.
No, so not Oscar bait. I'm sorry, but she's never, ever going to be up for an Oscar. She's just not.
Never say never.
I think she's a good actress. I think it's too bad that she's not, but she won't be.
Speaking of Oscars, by the way, did you know that Ann Thompson, who was on our podcast last week, is doing a podcast called Oscar Talk? We should link to it in the show notes.
Absolutely. I wonder if any of the movies mentioned in Oscar Talk will be shown at LACMA.
Oh, with the segue. Okay, so I guess it's time for Inside Baseball. That was your little hint there, wasn't it?
I'm just trying to help segue along.
Okay, well, a couple of weeks ago on Inside Baseball, we talked about the fact that the Los Angeles County Museum of Arts was ending their film program, which began, I believe, in 1969 or 1970. It began some time ago, because it had lost $1 million over the last 10 years, which, you know, is, I guess, $100,000 a year. And everybody was up in arms about this. Martin Scorsese wrote a letter. There was going to be a big meeting between Michael Govan, the director of the head curator for LACMA, who, incidentally, by the way, makes something like $1.5 million a year or some ridiculous salary.
Excellent point.
And so everybody was up in arms. There was a Twitter account called Save LACMA Film, and there was going to be a big meeting between, as I mentioned, Govan and the Save LACMA Film people. They called it the Popcorn Summit after Obama's Beer Summit.
Oh, God.
Hey, I thought it was actually, you know, not a bad...
Oh, I was supposed to laugh? How clever.
Not necessarily. I was just pointing out. Anyway, the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, the same group that puts the Golden Globe Awards together, and Time Warner Cable, the people you hate to pay every month, have thrown in $75,000 each. They've pledged $150,000 to the program to keep it up and running through June of 2010. So it will not close in October as previously announced.
Yay! This is great news.
This is good news. And these figures are so small, it's really sad. I mean, that they can't deficit finance a film series in L.A. for $150,000 a year. It seems crazy to me.
Well, I have to say, that museum must be making some kind of money, because I was going to go see the Pompeii exhibit there. It cost $50 to get in.
Wow.
And I said, you know what? I've been to Pompeii. It didn't cost me $50.
That's insane.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. So every Saturday night, and I believe Tuesday afternoons, you can go to LACMA if you're in Los Angeles or you're visiting Los Angeles. You can go to the Los Angeles County Museum of Art on Wiltshire Boulevard in the Miracle Mile and see a repertory movie.
And how much does it cost?
$1 million. No, $10, I believe.
Okay. Maybe. Is that like right up the street from me? It's so sad.
It's like $8 or $10. I don't know.
Just like buying a ticket at the regular movies. That's a lot of money.
Yeah. Couldn't they have made it like $5?
Right. Let it get subsidized and offered up to the people. I say, I'm with Sperling. The next time the head of LACMA's job comes up for renewal, guess what? He can scrape by on $1.1 million and they can fully fund the Film Society showings.
Oh, the Times did this huge expose on him where they basically said, you know, showed all of this, all of the perks he got. They kept an apartment for him in New York for 2 or 3 years at $30,000, and he got $300,000 to move his family from New York to L.A.
I want his job.
I was just going to say the same thing.
And I'll do it for half the price.
I'll be more than happy to take all the flack for canceling the film program.
Yeah. Have we covered everything?
I do think we've covered everything. So for links to all of the stories that we have discussed on this episode, or at least most of them since we kind of strayed from our show notes, you can visit our website at showbizsandbox.com. You can look for them in the show notes for August 30th. Our website is also where you'll find links to all of our social networking accounts, such as Twitter, LinkedIn, and Facebook. If you want to email us some feedback or send us hate mail or love mail, you can do so. The email address is dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Of course, you could always call us and leave us either prank voicemails or voicemails telling us how wonderful we are. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's toll-free, 888-567-7263. And if they're good enough, And don't berate us too much. We will play them on a future episode. If you want to send us news stories, you can do so through the social bookmarking website delicious.com. Just tag your links Showbiz Sandbox, all one word, and we do check that daily. Now, the music that you hear at the beginning and end of each episode of Showbiz Sandbox is by the popular indie group MGMT. You can visit their websites at whoismgmt.com or find them on MySpace at myspace.com/MGMT. Now, if you want to see the band in person, you can see them this week at the Fair Trade and Convention Center in Tel Aviv, Israel. That's a long way to go if you don't live in the Middle East.
Or if we could take a private jet.
Well, Paula Abdul can go see. I'll go with Paula. Electric Picnic is another event they're playing on September 4th at 3 p.m. That's a mighty early for a concert. That is in Ireland. And September 5th at 2 p.m., so they're getting earlier and earlier, the Orange Warsaw Festival in Warsaw, Poland. So there you have it. go see MGMT. Download their music. Darn it. All right. Well, Michael, Karen, thank you very much. Until next week, play nice.